This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Welcome this evening to the National Museum and to Visions Theatre. It's lovely to see so many of you here this evening. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the Aboriginal people whose land we're on today, their ancestors past and present. My name's Carolyn Forster and I'm President of the Friends of the National Museum, and we're delighted to be doing a partnership once again with the Open Garden Scheme this evening to share with our members and your supporters this wonderful lecture. You'll notice on your chair that you'll have a member's guest pass, which we have given you. You don't have to be a member to use that, so we hope that you might like to come to something at the Friends, something that's on our program. And we've left some items on your seats to give you an idea of the range of programs that we have to offer. We have especially one of the programs is Landmark Women, a program that's been running for quite a number of years, and that's a very popular, well-attended program, so I'd just like to draw that to your attention as well. One other thing that's happening for the Friends is that we're going to have a new lounge, which we're hoping will be open very soon. We're hoping for the public that it'll be open next week, so that we look forward to perhaps seeing you at our new lounge, which is on the ground floor and much more accessible to the galleries. Tonight it's my pleasure to introduce Helen Stevens. Helen is the board member of the Open Garden Australia and chair of the ACT and Country New South Wales Open Garden Australia and the regional committee, and she's going to introduce our guest speaker. Thank you very much, Helen. Thank you.
Thank you and good evening, everybody. It is with great pleasure that Open Gardens has been able to partner with the Friends of the National Museum. We're very pleased to be able to bring our guest this evening to you all. I too would just like to let you know that we've got an exciting year for Open Gardens. Our organisation is turning 25 this year, which is amazing, and grown from a little thing that was a germ of an idea in Victoria to something that's Australia-wide, promoting the love and knowledge of gardens for all Australians, hopefully to improve our lives and our living spaces. We are going to have a fabulous series of events to promote this particular year over and above our normal program. We are expecting that the guidebook for this coming year will be out at the end of August. Not everything that's happening will be in the guidebook because we've been able to negotiate things after the deadline for the guidebook. If you're interested in following our activities, I really hope you are, you can access up-to-date information, like literally up-to-date, on our website, which is www.opengarden.org.au. But you can Google Open Garden and it will appear. We also have an iPhone app, which if you want to not buy a guide, you can access the iPhone app, and that's fabulous too. So we're all very high-tech now. We tweet and we're looking at having Facebook, and it should be pretty amazing. We are very lucky that we're able to do all this basically with the help of marvellous volunteers who are committee selectors and garden owners, and we'd like to acknowledge those this year in particular because it wouldn't exist without the very hard work behind the scenes, tiny little bit of which you saw tonight. It is my particular pleasure tonight to introduce our guest speaker. We're thrilled that we were able to have Hugh McKay come and speak to us. He probably needs very little introduction to most of you. Certainly, I have been listening to him on the radio for many years and reading his frequent articles. Hugh is a social researcher and writer. He's the author of 13 books, six of which are bestsellers. His latest book, What Makes Us Tick, The 10 Desires That Drive Us, came out in 2010, and you probably saw that it was available down in the bookshop, and I'm sure copies will be available during the week beyond this night. In recognition of his pioneering work in social research, he's been awarded the honorary doctorates by Charles Sturt University, Macquarie University, New South Wales University and Western Sydney University. Not inconsiderable achievements. He is a fellow of the Australian Psychological Society, and in 2004 he received the University of Sydney's Alumni Award for Community Service. Hewer is currently an honorary professor of social science at the University of Wollongong, a former deputy chairman of the Australia Council, a former chairman of trustees of Sydney Grammar School, and was the inaugural chairman of the ACT Government's Community Inclusion Board. He has been a newspaper columnist for over 25 years, which I think is astounding and wonderful, and you would have known that he is a frequent guest on ABC Radio. It is with great pleasure that I ask Hugh McKay to join us this evening.
Thank you very much, Helen, and good evening, everybody. Before I talk specifically about gardens and why we love them, I want to step back to ask you a slightly more general question than just about why you love your garden or why you're mystified at the extent to which other people, perhaps members of your own family, love their gardens. The more general and fundamental question that I want to think about for a moment is a question which I think is the strangest question we humans ever ask ourselves. And I just want you to reflect for a moment on whether you've ever asked yourself this question. The question is, why did I do that? It's a question we very sensibly ask about other people all the time. Why did they do that? We know that spouses, kids, colleagues, neighbours, etc., are strange, and so it's not surprising that we're puzzled by their behaviour. Why did you do that? Is a perfectly reasonable question. But isn't it odd that most of us do things of our own volition and then look at what we've done and then say, why did I do that? Now, I want to approach the subject of why we love our gardens tonight, bearing in mind that much human behaviour seems puzzling at first because it's obviously irrational. And the only reason we're puzzled by irrational behaviour is that most of us, particularly if we've had a tertiary education, have been caught in the grip of this Western myth that humans are essentially rational creatures, and that if we behave irrationally, then that's not how we're supposed to behave. So to approach this business of our passion for gardens, I want to suggest, first of all, that we need to abandon that myth. Just take a look at human behaviour. Take a look at everything from falling in love to falling out of love, waging war, our propensity to violence, our superstitions, our phobias, our addictions, the belief, for example, that the Brumbies are a morally superior team to any other rugby team going around. Well, there you are. It seems to me the more you look at us, the more you'd be driven to the conclusion that by nature we're irrational. And that what's remarkable about humans is that if you take us at a very early age and educate us for 12 or more years and train us very, very carefully, we are capable of occasional and remarkable bursts of rational behaviour. But it takes all of that training and education and discipline in order to make us rational, because our default position is to be ruled more by the heart than the head. Our folklore has that right. So if we were rational, we would all have weed gardens because they grow so profusely, and you wouldn't have to pay nearly as much attention to your garden if you just let the weeds run. And there are people, of course, who do have weed gardens, some intentional and some quite unintentional. If we were completely rational, we'd probably concrete over the whole thing and paint something tasteful on it. Inside, we'd have the house adorned with plastic flowers if we loved flowers, because you'd only have to dust them occasionally and rearrange them from time to time. That'd be perfectly rational, but to a room full of people like you, it sounds, of course, abhorrent, because you know that we don't do things in order to be rational because we're human. When someone says to you, "Why can't you be more rational?" and we are capable of saying that to each other, the answer always should be, "Because I'm human. That's why I'm not rational." That's one reason why our behaviour should puzzle us often. The other reason, and this again comes very directly to answering the question posed by this lecture, the other reason is that we never do anything just for one reason. There's never a single or simple explanation for any piece of human behaviour. Everything we humans do is the outcome of a kind of dynamic interplay, interaction between a number of different desires that are constantly driving us. In the book, What Makes Us Tick, I've identified 10 desires that it seems to me are the fundamental 10 desires that are driving human behaviour all the time. So when you're trying to explain a particular piece of behaviour, you need to look at the list. You need to look at the 10 and say, not why did you do that, but how many of these desires were in play to produce this particular piece of behaviour. It's not just that they contribute in some kind of orderly, rational, harmonious fashion. They're often competing with each other. They're often colliding. They're often contradicting each other. But somehow, moment to moment, we blend them and they produce the things that we do. And if you're interested in how our desires interact and overlap and contribute in this dynamic way, then there's no better example of human behaviour done for a complex set of reasons than gardening. Now, I did suggest in the subtitle of this lecture that I was going to explore three of those desires in particular. And, of course, the more I got into thinking about all of this and preparing what I would say tonight, the more I realised that there are many more than three. So I'm going to deal with the three that seem to me to be the primary desires that help to account for our love of gardens. But then I want to talk about another four, because I think 7 out of the 10 are at work for serious gardeners. But let's deal with the big three first. And the first of those, and remember, I'm identifying each of these as one of the 10 basic desires that drive all kinds of human behaviour. But the first that seems to me particularly relevant here is the desire for my place. Now, we talk rather strangely about this sense of place, this sense of connection with place, connection with the land, etc. In Australia, in fact, in most societies that have indigenous populations, we talk about the sense of place as though it's somehow peculiar to indigenous people, as though they have some kind of mystical sense of place which we people, essentially European descendants, wouldn't be able to understand. That is rubbish. It's humans, not just indigenous peoples, it's humans who have this powerful, emotionally intense sense of connection to place. And the reason we have it is that we need it. That part of what makes us sane, part of what gives us a sense of identity, part of what contributes to our sense of emotional security is the knowledge that there are actual places on the planet that are somehow ours, mystically perhaps ours. That's why sometimes they're referred to as sacred sites. Even if you're not a religious believer, perhaps the term sacred site fits this case. These are places that symbolize us in some way, places that say things about us we're pleased to have said. Think about your own personal cultural history and think of the places that in some way stand for you or define you or perhaps deeply reassure you about who you are. For many people, such a place is the family home, the place where you grew up, if you happen to grow up in one particular place. Many Australians don't. But it's surprising how many people reach their middle years and their frail, elderly parents announce that they're finally going to sell the family home, and their fully mature adult offspring are saying, you can't do that, you know, that's our home. They haven't lived there perhaps for 30 years, but that's our home. Well, of course, they can sell it and they will sell it and it may be demolished or renovated or replaced by a shopping mall. And we get this tremendous sense of outrage when places that are precious to us are somehow transformed in that way. For some people, it's a den. For some people, it's a shed. Lots of blokes define themselves by their shed. I remember doing some research on this a few years ago, talking about people's sense of place, and a man in one of my studies was talking about how he and his wife were going to move to the Central Coast. And he was the advanced scout exploring the real estate market on the Central Coast, and he came home one weekend and said to his wife, I found just the place. It's got this massive shed. There's room for three cars, but lots of other stuff as well. I've got to have that shed. And his wife said, what about the house? And he said, bugger the house, I want that shed. Well, that's not all that unusual. We all have this sense of needing somewhere that will be ours. Regular churchgoers always sit in the same pew. Long-distance commuters always sit in the same seat in the same carriage. We get attached to places. For some people, it's sporting arenas. For some people, contemporary people, it's actually a mobile place called the car, the only place where they really feel comfortable and in control. Many migrants, particularly people who've migrated in their middle years, report the problem of what's described as migrant rootlessness arising from precisely this problem. People who've established a strong sense of place in their birth country and then have moved to a new country and simply don't have time to develop the same sense of powerful attachment to place. And so they feel they've left those places behind, haven't replaced them, and you often do hear migrants later in their lives saying, I don't really feel as if I belong in either place. Well, the sense of place is integral with who we are. I don't know whether all of you are able to remember the person with whom you shared your first romantic kiss. I'll just pause for a moment right now to reflect on that. I hope you can remember the person, but even if you can't remember the person, I'd be prepared to bet that you can remember where you were when it happened. It's like, where were you when when you heard the news that John F. Kennedy was shot? Everyone knows where they were. Why? It's an odd thing. Well, it's not an odd thing at all. Place is so integral with moments or phases of emotional intensity for us. There's some interesting research on, for those of you who are interested in team sports, some interesting research on why teams tend to win. Statistically, it's now well proven, teams tend to win more often when they're playing at home than when they're playing away games. And some intense research has been done into European soccer, which they strangely call football. Perhaps it has something to do with the fact that they use their feet, and American baseball. And in both these sports, tremendous, incontrovertible evidence of the home ground advantage. And so endless speculation about why this should be. Well, of course, once we understand the significance of place in our sense of identity, there's no mystery about why a team might play a little more aggressively, a little more skillfully, with a little more commitment when they're defending the sacred site that defines the team. That's our place. The latest bit of research on that, by the way, has demonstrated what you would predict, I suppose, which is that the testosterone levels in the bloodstream of soccer players is higher when they're playing on the home ground than when they're playing somewhere else. And the highest testosterone level is recorded for the goalie, who is, of course, defending the ultimate bit of sacred turf. Well, gardens are, of course, that place for many people, perhaps for almost everybody in this auditorium. My garden says something about me, something eloquent about me, which perhaps no other place in my life says quite so eloquently. For many people, my favourite spot, the place where I feel most myself, is in my garden or in a garden. In that same piece of research that I mentioned with the man and his shed, a woman in that study said that her favourite place was a rock in a public garden near where she lived. She said no one in her family, not even her husband, knows about this rock, but this is where she goes into this tranquil garden when she wants to be herself, when she needs to be alone with her thoughts to get frustrations out of her system, etc. Well, that's not unusual. A garden, there's something about a garden which has that potent emotional power for many people. So that's the desire for my place. The second of the big three that I want to touch on is the desire to connect. Now, we all know about the need to connect, but it's a complicated need because there are at least three dimensions to our desire to connect. We need to connect with ourselves, to have some degree of self-knowledge, some sense of who we are. We need to connect with others because we are social creatures and connection and communication is our lifeblood. And we also need to connect with the natural world. And one of the things that emerges very clearly from research is that if people fall short in any one of those three dimensions of being connected, then they're likely to experience a vague sense of uneasiness or restlessness or even some kind of neurosis. And it seems to me, when I reflect on this, that all three of those dimensions can be satisfied in a garden or in the process of gardening. Let me say the obvious one, of course, is the connection with the natural world. I want to say a bit more about that, but very briefly, let me deal with the other two. The desire to connect with ourselves. The Greeks, of course, have been the ancient Greeks. The modern Greeks aren't sure what they're recommending to anyone at the moment, but the ancient Greeks were recommending know thyself as a central proposition for humans. My psychological hero in many ways, an American psychotherapist called Carl Rogers, many of you will be familiar with Rogers' work. Reflecting on 40 years' work as a psychotherapist, Rogers said, there is only one problem. And by that he meant, it doesn't matter whether people are coming into the consulting room with relationship breakdowns or addictions or phobias or whatever other neurotic symptoms they might have, it always in the end, Rogers felt, came down to the question, who am I? What kind of person am I that's got myself into this situation? If I could understand myself better, perhaps I wouldn't be in the situation I'm in. And so all of us are on this quest. For many of us, it takes a lifetime to answer the question, who am I? But we know there are some shortcuts. We know there are some magical pathways towards self-knowledge. We know that one of them is creative self-expression. Artists, poets, sculptors, dancers, people who do these kinds of things seem to have very ready access to an understanding of who they are through the paradox of finding yourself by losing yourself. And isn't that true of the garden? That you lose yourself in the act of gardening, and in that process, something happens which leads to a greater understanding of the self. I don't know how many gardeners I've heard say things like, I'd go mad if I didn't have the garden. I'd be visiting the psychotherapist if I wasn't getting my hands in the soil. And there's a lot in that, because a solitary activity and a highly creative activity like gardening is one of those classic places where we can lose ourselves and therefore find ourselves. And then, of course, there's the communication, the social aspect of being connected, and the fellowship of gardeners. The gardening community is a very obvious, a particular form of connection with other people. I want to say a bit more about that later. But the obvious dimension of the desire to connect that's satisfied by gardening is, of course, this, again, fundamental human desire to be connected with the natural world. A group of American psychologists have recently, in studying various levels of neurosis in children, have identified what they describe as the nature deprivation syndrome. There's always a syndrome. And the nature deprivation syndrome, of course, is all about kids who don't get out into the fresh air, don't swim, don't walk in the bush, don't kick a ball around a park or help in the garden or do some other thing in the natural world. That sense of being disconnected from the natural world produces uneasiness, restlessness, shortens the attention span, all of these classic signs of the so-called nature deprivation syndrome. And of course, it's to do with being indoors and, in particular, spending too much time in front of a screen. Well, we're all familiar, I think, with the nature deprivation syndrome in ourselves. We know that we go slightly crazy if we don't get outside, if we don't go walking, if we don't get into the garden. Even people who live in perhaps to some extent in Canberra, although there's no real high-rise in Canberra, but certainly in cities like Sydney and Melbourne, people live in high-rise apartment blocks, highly urbanised, seriously removed from the natural world, but almost without exception, they'll have a pathetic little pot plant on the balcony struggling for survival, as if to say, look, I know my life is not exactly in touch with the natural world, but see, this is my link. Some of you are old enough perhaps to remember the pet rock phenomenon when a Californian marketing guru in the 80s, I think, marketed thousands and thousands of pet rocks to people, complete with a handbook on how to care for your pet rock. Now, most people who purchased pet rocks or just went out and got some of their own and put them on the mantelpiece found them, as pets, deeply unresponsive. And of course it was a joke, but it was a highly symbolic joke. This was a person saying, yes, we all live these fast-paced, urbanised lives. We're out of touch with nature, and we haven't got time to care for a real pet. Put a rock on your mantelpiece and that'll remind you that there is a natural world. Well, gardeners know all about that, and they do better than rocks, and they do better than struggling pot plants. We know that being in gardens, not even necessarily getting your hands in the soil, but being in gardens is one of the easiest and most satisfying ways to feel as if we are part not just of the natural world in the sense of a garden, but part of the cosmos, part of the ecosystem, that we are in some way united with the natural world. How crucial this is to our personal sanity. Why else do people do things like pay money to swim with dolphins? Why do people buy tickets to sit in a grandstand and watch penguins swim ashore at dusk? This is irrational behaviour at one level, but of course it's all about wanting to be connected with the natural world. Rather ironically, perhaps, one of the forms of television program that's guaranteed to get big ratings is nature documentaries. And I like the irony of that, that even sitting watching it on television gives people a sense of being connected with the natural world. Well, pet ownership, all these things that we do that take us into a sense of connection with the natural world are deeply therapeutic for us. And the third of the big three, perhaps a slightly less obvious one, particularly if your garden at the moment feels somewhat out of control, but this is the desire for control. Again, one of the most fundamental of human drivers, and the one that probably more than any other on my list of 10 gets us into trouble. It's potentially the most frustrating of all the desires that drive us. Like all of these desires, you can see where it came from. It has very primitive origins. The desire for control for primitive humans was all about how to survive in what looked like a fairly hostile environment. We felt we had to get this hostility somehow under control. And even today, most of the classic textbook phobias are about loss of control. Fear of flying, fear of travelling in lifts, fear of sitting too far from the exit in an auditorium, fear of crowds, fear of open spaces. All these phobias are essentially the same phobia, and it's fear of losing control. The reason why this desire for control gets us into so much trouble so often is that most of us look in the wrong place. In fact, we look in a very dangerous place for ways to satisfy the desire for control. And the dangerous place, where the most dangerous place we can look, is, of course, to other people. The idea that we could control other people is an idea that is doomed to failure and also doomed to frustrate us. It takes many of us a very long time to figure out that other people, like most of our circumstances, other people are beyond our control, and that the only life you can actually control is your own. Yes, you can advise and guide and criticize and discipline other people, your kids, spouses, colleagues, etc., but we can't control anyone else. So now we go into the garden, and here is the most harmless place on earth in which to satisfy the desire for control. You can't tie your spouse to a stake, but you can tie your roses to stakes. And it's all about control, but in that case, no one is going to be damaged or upset. Trimming, pruning, weeding, mowing, sweeping, this is all therapeutic stuff, because whether you realize it or not, every one of those activities is helping to satisfy your fundamental primitive desire for control. So those are the three of what I would regard as the big desires that are satisfied by gardening. But that's by no means the end of the story, because the more you think about the passion for gardening, the more you realise there's a lot more to it even than the desire for control, or the desire to connect, or the desire for my place. What about the desire to be useful, which is another one of the 10 desires that drive us? Even though people are cynical about the idea that humans are capable of altruism, are full of desire for activities that will play a useful part, help to make the world a better place and so on, the evidence is incontrovertible. That's the kind of people we are. We are driven by our desire to be useful, and nothing feels worse to us than the criticism that we're pretty useless. Imagine how you'd feel if someone's judgment on you was, well, he's been a pretty useless father, she's a pretty useless member of the committee. These are not things we like to hear about ourselves, because deep within us is this desire to be useful. Look what happened just over a year ago when Brisbane was hit by those appalling floods, and thousands of people arrived by the busload with their mops and buckets to be useful, to help total strangers clean up their flood-affected properties. Well, isn't the garden a place where you can't possibly feel useless? There's always something to be done. There's always something to be achieved in the garden. And when you're gardening, you're being useful. And when you're gardening, you're helping to make the world a better place. I mentioned when I was talking about the desire to connect that there is a kind of fellowship of gardeners, and so that relates to another one of the basic desires that drive us, which is the desire to belong. we are social creatures. We, although there are hermits, there are isolates, but they're very rare, they're very exceptional. Most of us absolutely thrive on human contact. Most of us need, in particular, little herds to belong to. We are herd animals. We used to live in domestic herds. Australia 100 years ago, the average Australian household was a herd. If you define a herd as somewhere between 5 and 8 people, that's a pretty typical human herd size. That's the perfect size for a dinner party, for example. If you invite 10 people, it'll subdivide into 2 herds. It's a perfect size for a work group, for a committee, for a management span of control, around about 5 to 8. That's the classic human herd. And that's how we used to live. We used to live in domestic herds. Now, of course, we don't live in domestic herds. The average Australian household today is 2.2 people. That's sub-herd size. In fact, the largest single household category in Australia now is the single-person household. That accounts for about 26 or 27% of all Australian households. And by the year 2026, the ABS is predicting about 35% of all Australian households will contain just one person. This is no longer a herd-based, domestically speaking, a herd-based society. By the way, this is not just Australia. This is a Western phenomenon. Well, what happens when your household shrinks well below the size of a domestic herd? The answer is you have to find other herds to connect with, which is why we've seen the book club phenomenon explode as it has in the last 15 or 20 years. And why, incidentally, people who belong to book clubs will typically say that at some point in the evening, someone always says, "Don't you think we should say something about the book?" And that's, of course, because we're herding. The book is a wonderful excuse for getting together. And if it wasn't a book club, it might be a poetry class or a current affairs discussion group or a U3A group or something else. If you can't think of any other way of connecting with the herd, you just go and graze with the herd. Even Canberra now has a food court or two, that wonderful euphemism for the public trough, the food court. Where we just line up with the other cattle and you don't even have to moo if you don't feel like it, but you can feel as though you're connected with the human herd. Well, of course, gardeners have ready-made herds to connect with. Garden clubs are proliferating just as book clubs are. Community gardens creating this fantastic opportunity not only for people to get all the therapeutic benefits that I've already been speaking about out of the act of gardening itself and the creation and nurture of a garden, but also, of course, belonging to a social group of people who are gardening together or who are part of some informal collection of gardeners who are constantly exchanging cuttings and so on. The desire to belong is also satisfied by gardening. And there are two others. The desire for something to happen. Now, you may think this is a bit far removed from gardening, but I'm not sure. Just wait till spring and see what a transformation is about to happen in your own garden and indeed in the gardens of Canberra. All of us need something to look forward to. It's another one of the characteristics of human beings. We have this desire for something to happen. The desire, at the extreme, it's a desire for excitement, but certainly for something to look forward to. Well, isn't that something that is satisfied for the gardener? A person who is seriously attuned to the life of a garden is a person who is constantly looking forward, waiting for something to happen. If you're alert, if you're in touch with a garden, you're not just vaguely connected with nature, you're actually part of the adventure of nature. Gardeners tend not to seek their thrills in, for example, skydiving or heli skiing or speedboat racing. The gardener's desire for something to happen is satisfied in a rather more subdued way But there's no less sense of anticipation in the gardener who is tending and nurturing a garden than there is for people who seek these more extreme forms of excitement in their lives. And the last of the seven that I want to mention, of these desires that drive us that can be satisfied by gardeners, is the one which you can never leave out of a list of the desires that drive almost any aspect of human behaviour. And that's the desire to be taken seriously. Almost everything we do is to some extent an expression of our deep human need to be appreciated, to be noticed, to be acknowledged, to be valued. And people who are serious about their gardens use the garden. Again, not necessarily consciously, but use the garden in that way. I'm proud of my garden because of what it says about me and what it's going to say to you about me. My garden is going to be one of the ways that you will take me serious. Take my garden seriously, take me seriously. Well, that's seven out of my list of possible 10 desires that drive us. I'll leave you to discover what the other three are on the list. But is it any wonder, when you look at all of those fundamental human desires being satisfied by gardening, is it any wonder that gardeners get such a kick out of gardening? Is it any wonder that gardeners talk about the thrill of gardening? Is it any wonder that gardeners become as passionate as they do about not just their own gardens, but other people's gardens and public gardens as well? Being in and around gardens for the person who's got it, for the person who's seen what a garden can do for us in therapeutic terms, is a wonderful and often, as I say, even a thrilling experience. It's primitive, it's stimulating, it's relaxing, and it's deeply rewarding. And to conclude, let me return to my opening point. It's a very good example of the principle that we never do anything just for one reason. Why do we love our gardens? There couldn't possibly be one answer, as there couldn't possibly ever be one answer to a question like, why did you do that or why did I do that? It's always going to be the outcome of this dynamic interplay between the 10 desires that are driving us. In the case of gardens, I'm suggesting 7. And whenever we're puzzled by other people's behaviour in or out of a garden, including being puzzled by our own behaviour, simply look at the 10 desires and say, how many are in play here, and the mystery will be solved. Well, you've been very patient, but it's your turn now. We do have plenty of time for discussion of any points that I've raised, or argument or questions. There are a couple of roving microphones, so if anyone would like to ask a question, just put your hand up and I guess one of the microphone monitors will arrive. So do you have any questions?
Hugh, what about the desire to produce something tangible, something that we have created, knowing that we can produce it without pesticides, fungicides, that sort of thing?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a combination of the desire to be useful and the desire for something to happen. I think that's... But it's very true. I mean, we do need tangible evidence of our usefulness. It's one reason why people who work in administrative jobs or cerebral jobs often experience a lot of frustration because the output is not always so obvious. And such people often do have great passion for a garden or for carpentry or for some other really tangible thing, because we do have, as you're suggesting, this need for our usefulness to be demonstrated. I remember reading a few years ago about the English playwright Alan Bennett, one of my favourite writers, who said that he had discovered... I mean, writers are famous for looking for things to distract them. Bennett had discovered a way of occupying a full 10 minutes in productive work, which involved cleaning the lint filter in his washing machine. He said, if you do this carefully, it can take 10 minutes. Now, that's part of just like students who decide to paint their room when an essay is due. We're always looking for a distraction. But I think it's more than that. It's also that someone who is a writer and who can often spend a day only getting a sentence or two out needs evidence of usefulness. So even cleaning the lint filter might do it, but something like a garden is, I mean, the point you're making is absolutely valid. A garden is production. And, of course, it also relates, the modern garden relates to our ancient agrarian origins as well. There's no doubt about that. Even pet ownership relates to our ancient animal husbandry practices in the past. So all these things have got very deep roots, of course, but absolutely. His tangible... I mean, if you live a life in your mind, there's nothing better than gardening to bring you back to earth, literally. Thank you. Yes, there are several questions there.
I wonder if you just comment on the concept today where many people get someone to design their garden, to build their garden, to maintain the garden.
Yeah, they're the people who I think should probably concrete it over and paint a nice mural on it. There's none of the therapeutic benefits that I'm referring to tonight are available to those people. It's a bit like people who say, I'd love to have a dog. So they acquire a dog and then they pay someone to walk it and to wash it and look after it and say, isn't it lovely to have a dog? It's not that there's no desire being satisfied, but none of these desires are being satisfied. There are other categories of desire, like the rather ethereal desires for beauty or justice or truth and so on. And I suppose you could say someone who's paid a landscape gardener to design it and plant it and someone else to maintain it is perhaps satisfying their desire for beauty in their life, and I don't mean to mock that, but these hands-in-the-soil therapeutic benefits that I'm referring to are just not available to them. They don't know what they're missing. And, of course, the argument put forward by many people who don't know what they're missing in relation to any activity like gardening, which is a slow-down activity. I mean, there's no instant garden. There's no quick way to get a climbing rose to climb. I've just discovered that. but these people say, I'm just too busy, you know. And of course, they're consigning themselves to a life of stress and restlessness and uneasiness, which may not be explicable to them. They may not know why they feel restless. If you could take them aside and say, look, if you just prune your own garden, just pull out your own weeds, you'd be amazed at how different you'd feel. And if there's no time for that, then everything's absolutely out of whack.
Steering away from the garden, just for a moment, and looking at your first point, my place. I heard or read somewhere that during the bombing, for example, Second World War, that the removal or the destruction of a landmark in a city like London, for example, mm-hmm. was more destructive for the general populace, for the feeling of, than reading about a number of people being killed, mm-hmm. because it impacted on everyone. Because it was a symbol of my place, I guess.
Mm. Yes. Thank you for that. That's certainly what you're saying is absolutely true. Research certainly confirms that, and of course, not just in London, many other cities, German cities as well. This sense of horror that a place that was not just familiar to us but intensely symbolic for us has gone. Is shocking in a way that's almost inexpressible for people. At a less intense level, of course, it's the problem of the family home being, that I mentioned before, the family home being demolished. What's happened? You can't do that. That's part of me. And we do feel that about public buildings, public spaces, landmarks of various kinds. Mm.
there. I've been a Kew gardener now for more than 50 years. But when you are actively involved in the garden, you've also got to face the reality of death and disease. Your impatience suddenly blooming, and then a disease hits them and they die. Similarly with snapdragons, with rust. Mm. We in Canberra have...
I can see these are harrowing events you're referring to.
They are. We in Canberra, of course, until recently, had experienced a protracted drought, and many of the beautiful trees died. Where do we find meaning in those events of demise and death that are part of gardening?
Yes, thank you for that. A crucial point. In fact, I wish I'd mentioned it, but this is a good opportunity to raise it. You can't enter into a sense of being at one with the natural world without confronting death. I mean, life makes absolutely no sense unless we've acknowledged that death is integral and that that is what will happen to all of us and to everyone we love and to our pets and our plants as well. The garden, fit for kids in particular, the garden is a wonderful early lesson about, I suppose, mortality, death, disease, disability. All of those things are graphically there in everyone's garden. And I do think it's nonsense to say I'm at one with the universe and isn't everything wonderful. I'm at one with the universe and isn't everything either wonderful or terrible all at once. It's a lovely point to make. And I'm sorry about your snapdragons.
Relating to the drought, it came to my mind that I have a garden to be surrounded by green. And my whole persona, you know, thrives in being in green. And I was interesting in Canberra during this protracted drought.
Yes.
I think people suffered and got prickly, to be honest.
Yes.
And then when the drought broke and became green, people's demeanours lifted.
Mm.
And it was fascinating. I've just had a visit to the Middle East, and in some areas of the Middle East there's no green. And perhaps I'll leave the rest of that unsaid.
Yes, yes. No, look, absolutely right. A lovely example. Not a lovely example, a clear example of the point. There's no doubt that our sense of... That's what this nature deprivation syndrome is really all about. If because of circumstances, living in a highly urbanised situation or a wasteland after invasion and war and so on, or a drought, we have the sense of there being no natural element for us to relate to, it's deeply disturbing for most of us. In Ballarat, in Victoria, a town I visited a couple of months ago, during the drought, Lake Wendouree dried up. And people, it's now full again, but people talking, it's a shallow lake, people talking about the effect on the city of Ballarat of the lake having just become a dust bowl was very, very an exact echo of what you're describing. The city was depressed by what had happened to the lake. They tried to make the most of it. They had foot races on the rowing course, and they had bonfires and all sorts of things to try and make light of this. But of course, they couldn't, because it was such an integral part of the natural environment for that city.
Thank you very much, Hugh. I remember a wonderful cartoon in Punch of a society lady running a garden party. One of the guests pointed to a huddled figure in the corner, shabbily dressed, digging up weeds, and she said, "Is that your gardener?" And she said, "No, that's my husband. He hates parties." So he had his priorities in the right way. I would like to ask you a question about the fact that gardening can be a rational activity. During the war in Britain, there was a Dig for Victory campaign in which a lot of lawns were dug up for the purpose of growing food. And that saved an awful lot of people from going hungry. I was bitten by the same bug because I swapped trying to score tries at rugby with the goal of growing potatoes and tomatoes.
Mm. Mm.
Now, I think a wonderful thing that's happening in Australia now and many other countries is primary school children growing their own vegetables.
Mm.
And it's, I think, a wonderful educational experience. Not only can they bring home food that tastes so much better than they can get in shops, but they've achieved a goal. They learn about ecosystems, and they start a long process of education that our habitat is this planet. It's not a collection of buildings. It's the planet. And I think let's hope that that process extends.
Mm. Yes, thank you for that. Agree entirely, of course. And I didn't mention vegetables at any stage, but, of course, the vegetable question is an extension of that earlier point about gardening being a productive. You're actually producing something, not just beautiful flowers and other plants, but edible produce as well. And I agree about the educational value for kids, absolutely. Yes. I'm still trying to convince my wife that we should start growing vegetables. Lots of people where I live in the Southern Highlands are growing vegetables. And she says, no, you know what happens, you know, it all comes at once and then you're just having to give it away and, you know, you think you're going to live on this, but it doesn't work. And there is some evidence for that in our street.
Yes, Hugh. Just one comment on an earlier person speaking about getting an Azure Garden designer. I have these people that actually do. I design the gardens. We get the maintenance done. They don't have any part in the garden. But always with those people, I always try and insist that they do plant at least one tree.
Mm.
And then when they have the first barbecue to open their garden, not to the public, but to their friends,
yes, yeah.
Then they can say yes. And the effort we had in digging that one hole, oh, boy, oh, boy. But there is also a disturbing trend, and certainly we see it in Canberra, of smaller and smaller blocks, the McMansion with four or five bedrooms.
Mm.
Most of the area is concreted over so they can put their three, four, four-wheel drives. In London they call it the Chelsea tractors.
Mm.
And there is very little room for anything to do with gardening, and that is exactly what they want.
Mm.
And we see this time and again in expanding suburbs in Canberra where the blocks are down to 400, 450 square metres, no room for gardening.
Yes.
This is a disturbing trend, I think, that is happening all over.
Yeah, absolutely right. And, of course, Canberra doesn't have it alone. I mean, it's exactly the same thing is blighting Sydney and Melbourne and all the other capital cities. And, I mean, that's all about greed, of course. I mean, developers' greed. It's not the householders so much. They're getting what they can afford. But there has been this huge change in the mentality of developers and of local government to say, well, we'll minimise the blocks, we'll have no footpaths, et cetera, et cetera. All things which are antithetical to what we know to be some of the most therapeutic aspects of community living, like having enough land for a garden and for kids to run around in the backyard and having a footpath where people may actually bump into each other and have a conversation. But that relates, of course, to another one of the 10 desires that drive us, one that I didn't mention in relation to gardening, the desire for more. I mean, we are just a very greedy, insatiable species, and it doesn't matter what it is we want, whether it's money or sex or travel or fitness or, you know, whatever it is, if we love it, we can't get enough. And we tend to go overboard, and that's unhappily. I mean, even you'd think by now we'd be really enlightened about this. We know about what makes communities work. We know that I've done the research myself. We know that if you ask people who are moving into a new development, suburban development, what are the things they really want, the things they will say they really want, we'd love to have a little park in our street. You know, if only the developer would set aside one of the blocks to be public area or a community garden or a park or something, and we want some kind of identifiable town centre, some place where there's a square and a fountain or a clock or something that gives us... Yeah, well, of course. But of course, some developers are extremely enlightened about this and do all of those things. And many are just ignoring what their customers really want and just giving them stuff that they can afford, but that will actually be the opposite of therapeutic, will be anti-communitarian in its effects. It's an unfolding suburban tragedy around Australia, around the West, not just Australia.
I can't substantiate this, Hugh, but I've heard that people...
Could you just wave at me so I can see? Yes, sorry.
I've heard that people with a tertiary education are more likely to have native gardens. Can you comment on that? Have you heard that?
I love that kind of correlation. I have absolutely no idea whether there's... Yes, well, it must be true. because I'm a social researcher, when anyone ever says anything like that to me, I immediately start trying to develop the theory that would explain that. So far, I'm at a loss. It's interesting, yes. Yes.
I got into event management and I learned very fast that the more of the senses you appeal to in an event, the more successful it's likely to be. So I'm saying to you that I've discovered as a sculptor, this is the most powerful thing I have, the need to touch things.
Mm.
And that's, for me, also in gardening.
Yes.
And I think, you know, when we garden, we smell, we see, and we touch.
Yes.
And it's the most powerful
sense. And we hear.
Yes.
We hear them.
The most powerful sense for gaining empathy.
Mm.
And I think we don't talk about that.
Mm. Yes. No, thank you for adding that in. That's a vital extra point to be made. Absolutely agree. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
There's something that's been swirling around the discussion. The issue of beauty, how does that fit into your construction of desires, where for some of us, you know, that aesthetic is a hunger and a deep need?
Mm.
How does that fit for you?
Yeah, look, I acknowledge it's not one of my 10. I should have said that the 10 that I've developed in this new book are what I've described as social desires. So they're all about... how we live in community, how we develop a sense of identity and make connections and so on. And I was fitting gardening into that. But I think I did say in response to an earlier question, there's obviously another kind of desire that gardening also satisfies, which is this more ethereal, aesthetic desire for beauty. It doesn't drive everybody, and it's one of those things that's so hard to explain and generalise about, because your beauty is my ugliness, you know, all that stuff. So you can, with the social desires, you can say these are virtually universal desires. We are all driven by the desire for my place. We're all driven by the desire to belong, the desire to connect, etc. But when it gets to be, you know, I'm not even sure you can say that humans as a species are universally driven by the desire for beauty. The evidence seems to contradict that. Some are. But you can say the same of justice. Some are driven by a passionate desire for justice, and many are not. But for those who have it, of course, it can be almost everything. And if beauty is the one we're talking about, then the garden, of course, is high on the list. And for many gardeners who are driven by that aesthetic, the garden is perhaps the main way they satisfy it, because it is all these other things as well. I mean, going to a gallery is a lovely thing for admiring beauty, and landscapes, panoramas are lovely for admiring beauty. But you're not getting the same therapeutic benefit from any of those that you're getting from actually creating the beauty. I think we're through.
Yeah.
Thank you. Good.
May I?
just wanted to present you with a small gift on behalf of the Friends, so thank you very much, but the Open Garden Scheme are going to thank you properly. But this is just a wee gift, a membership to the Friends of the National Museum. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Hugh. I was speaking to someone earlier this evening who said that one of the things about Hugh McKay when they hear him speak is that he seems to gather all those amorphous thoughts you've had floating around in your mind and somehow get them into order and articulate them beautifully, and he certainly did that this evening. It was insightful and wonderful to hear what you had to say. I hope I can remember it all so I can talk about it later on. We thank you very much for giving us your time tonight and for your insights, and we wish you a safe journey home. Thank you. And just before we go, I'd like to thank again the Friends of the National Museum of Australia and the National Museum of Australia itself for allowing us to conduct this wonderful evening here. Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.